Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome to the December 6th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson where? Right here. He's an economist, an author, the host of the Capital Record podcast, and the founder of the eponymous investment firm, the Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will.
You are moving with dispatch this morning. I hope all's well.
Everything's great. It's one of those days. I generally have like four meetings in a day. Today I have eight. Mm. And remember, I don't like meeting with anybody ever. If I could have an entirely text-driven relationship with my kids, I would.
So they've told
me. That part's not true. It's whoever is going to write me to say you need to be a better dad. I love my kids.
You do. They tell me that all the time when I tuck them in. Okay, so we got a number of questions and comments this week. If you don't mind, I'll blast through just a few of them. Jeffrey Ronald says, pardon the captious observation on David's bizarre sense of penology, though I don't give a tinker's damn about what happens to Elizabeth Holmes. Wouldn't every white-collar criminal love the option of serving time by cold calling for a nonprofit instead of wearing an orange jumpsuit in the slammer?
What do you think?
I think that, the answer is yes, they would. But I think the question more important than that is, what is society's benefit? I don't regard their preferences as paramount in sentencing. I regard society's needs as paramount. And so I would just say, I'd rather have Elizabeth Holmes under close supervision, cold calling people for California Policy Center.
You know how I feel.
Yeah. Okay. Steve Austin writes, David certainly went off on the Theranos sentencing, and he was right. Holmes is clearly no one you want to get near, and she may hurt many badly. But 11 years of Orange is the New Black is just dangerous, performative nonsense. He agrees with us, more or less.
Oh, I like that. I don't think I saw his email there.
He says, rape in the first degree in New York State is 5 years. This feels like a flex. Government prosecutor saying we can do this to her and to you, too. So, question.
Well, hold on. I have a question.
Please.
About what he just said. Mm-hmm. Why are feminists and those in the Me Too world and those that are, you know, disgusted by the patriarchal abuse of women and the sexualizing of women and the objectifying and all those things, why do they tolerate rape being a 5-year sentence and white collar crime being an 11-year sentence? Why do they think that's okay?
Because if they didn't have double standards, they'd have no standards at all.
All right.
Here's his question, Steve Austin's. At what point does taking investors' money and failing at an enterprise become fraud? It's not really clear to me that Holmes knew Theranos was unattainable, even as she faked results. That's a good question, and I don't have an answer for that.
I don't either. I mean, at the end of the day, there is a school of thought that says it's not illegal to be bad at a business, and it's not illegal for your goal to have failed. The thing with her, though, anyone who's trying to defend her, see, me saying I don't think she should do 11 years in prison is not me defending her. This mm-hmm. chick was a criminal.
Mm-hmm. But okay, so that's the question, though.
The criminality is from the fact that there is absolutely indisputable evidence that she did know stuff wasn't working and was lying to investors.
Right.
And to Walgreens, who was the one, you know, sucker in the whole deal that tried to go platform this not real technology. And so, again, I happen to, you know some of the victims mm-hmm. very well. And no one, and I'm not going to say who they are, but you'll know who some of them are, too. They are not people that are going to be, anyone's going to be sympathetic to. Very wealthy people losing a lot of money never gets anyone upset. Mm. But it should be against the law in our country to lie to wealthy people and take money from wealthy people. It should not be illegal to fail in a business. I agree with that. But there's no question that she was guilty of fraudulent activity to cover up the unsuccessfulness of the project.
Yeah, and, you know, being a former journalist full-time myself, I'm especially sensitive to the fact that she apparently sicked private investigators on journalists and tried to
problem with that.
Miserable.
That's all. I don't care.
All right. From David Hallmeyer. David, he says, you, David, described a conundrum he's been wrestling with since at least 2006. Here's his note. I completely agree we need to take responsibility to clean up our own party. To my mind, that's what primaries are for. And then we suck it up and vote R in the general because a bad R is better than a D. But doing that might damage the Republican brand. So how do we know when for the sake of the brand to go against a bad Republican in a general election?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a great question. I'm sorry to those that periodically will write us and say, please don't bring your silly faith into things. But one of the tenets, I think, of Christian ethics is that those things that are forbidden are forbidden, those things that are permitted, and that there are some things that are not forbidden or permitted, but rather require wisdom. And wisdom is developed over the cultivation of virtues, character, maturity. So there's this book in the Bible called Proverbs. There are other books that we refer to as wisdom literature as well, Ecclesiastes and so forth. And that's really, to me, why those books are there, for those things that require some degree of wisdom. So I have a hard and fast rule. Like, let's say, for example, I have a hard and fast rule that I won't vote for a neo-Nazi.
Mm. That's weird.
Now, what do you think on that one?
I think, as our friend Jeffrey Ronald told me, who hasn't invited Joseph Goebbels to a dinner party?
But do you agree with that line?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, and then you're a Catholic. Would you be willing to vote for a Protestant?
Of course.
Okay, so your line is somewhere between Protestant and neo-Nazi. All right, we're making progress here.
Keep in mind, I'm post-Vatican II child.
Yes.
So,
well,
Catholics.
By definition, every Catholic's post-Vatican II.
This is true. If they're alive right now, yes.
I think that we need to develop lines that are both. I love Bill Buckley's mantra that I would vote for the best possible Republican who has a chance of winning. And yet, do I think that there are times where, to the question, you are doing long-term damage? Like, do I believe history is going to remember the Trump moment as one in which there was a lot of short-term gain? Yes. And do I think it will be remembered as that in exchange for short-term gain, there was a lot of long-term pain? Mm. I most certainly do. And I'm not spiking the football, though, because it is true. I've been saying that for 7 years. Jonah Goldberg might have more right to spike the football here than anybody, because he's taken a lot of flack. I've taken no flack, largely because if anyone said it, I didn't read it. But but you know, Jonah's in this mix, you know, where I'm out managing money all day, and I don't really care what people think about what I'm saying politically. Look, there's gray areas on this stuff. Child molesters, neo-Nazis, it's easy to draw the line there. But just general ass clowns like Marjorie Taylor Greene, would I say it's black and white wrong to vote for her? No. Would I say that there's a trade-off that people ought to be a little more self-aware of? I would. But like, to me, I would fix that problem in a second if I lived in that community. It's where subsidiarity comes in. I don't care enough to go fix that congressional district. I'm too busy in the other eight places I live. So, but do you need to have a primary candidate that goes and takes these people out? And for the love of God, Republicans need to quit talking like primaries don't matter. You can fight against someone. If you want to say lesser two evils, then you cannot say it to a general. And even then, you may be wrong because of this other deeper discussion. But in a primary, then go let the best candidate win and go make the argument and persuade people. And if they don't persuade, they don't. But that's where I think the Republicans lost the midterms of 2022. Was not in November. It was in the primaries.
A moment ago, you set the parameters at Nazi versus Protestant.
No. I did, those are just some bandwidths. I'm willing to narrow from there.
Well, I want to narrow.
I mean, I'd even vote for like a Lutheran Protestant if I had to. You know,
They're too Catholic, aren't they, for you? I wonder, though, let's just run Nazi to anti-Semite or anti-Semite to the Nazi, because I think Marjorie Taylor Greene has made some claims, Jewish space lasers and that sort of thing.
Okay, so again, even anti-Semite, I find anti-Semitism contemptible, but I also think...
Careful.
I make a distinction between anti-Semites who hate Jews and anti-Semites who are uninformed morons.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of the conspiratorial stuff with that is not the hate-filled anti-Semitism, it's the just performative anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. All of it is despicable. But like what Kanye said with Alex Jones, like just to hear, look, guys, as a rule of thumb, if you're doing an interview with Alex Jones,
you're crazy.
Alex Jones is the reasonable one in the room, then something's gone really, really off. And so, yeah, I think that like what Kanye said would be beyond any pale of acceptability. You know, by the way, this whole thing, it's a very important subject, pre-15 and post-22. These subjects are worthy of our dialogue and discussion. But for the most part, you and me and this person who asked the question notwithstanding, most people, they don't have an ethical tension or pragmatic arm wrestling around these issues. All that matters is who the person is against. Like, so if Tucker can have Kanye on and he can say that another person like Mark Zuckerberg that they don't like is bad, that's good enough for them. And I would suggest that you keep thinking that way. You will lose so many elections, your head will spin.
Yeah.
And you will deserve it.
So I want to thank everybody who wrote in, because there were, I don't know, 24 more.
I love how you had to tell me to be careful. Like, you thought I was going to go anti-Semite.
Well, I don't know. No, I didn't think you were going to go anti-Semite. I just know how quick people are to spin something.
Yeah. No, because I'm pretty savvy.
I think you are.
I also took to heart what Dave Chappelle said on Saturday Night Live.
What was it? What, remind me.
35 years as a professional comedian, I've never found two words that go together to be a great idea. The Jews.
That's right. Okay, so we haven't talked about this man in a long time, John Sutter. It was
finally.
I know you've been waiting. In January of 1848, gold is discovered at Sutter's Mill. We've talked about that story before. There's lots of fun. There are many, many fun facts in there. But that's January of 1848. By the end of 1848, I'm sorry, let's just go 1 month later. So gold is discovered in January. In February, we have the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. We talked about that famously on the show. That's the treaty that ends the U.S.-Mexico War and cedes vast swaths of the Southwest to the U.S., the land that had formerly been under the Mexican flag and before that the Spanish. So that's in like the space of 30 days. You have discovery of gold and the end of war and the Mexican cession. Here's what's fascinating. At the end of that same year, just a few months later in December, James K. Polk, who's president, delivers his State of the Union, in which he says, you know what? I can certify this now. Numerous state experts have looked at this. There's real gold in California. And San Francisco goes from about it's then called Yerba Buena. San Francisco goes from about 1,000 people to 25,000 in the space of 1 year. And hundreds of thousands of more people are still on their way to California at this point. And they're coming from all over the Pacific Rim, China, Japan, etc. They're coming around the Horn of Africa in some cases to go to the toward the east to sail west. And they're going around the southern tip of South America to come up the west coast. They're coming in such numbers that as they arrive on ships, the ships are either just abandoned completely by the sailors and turned into building materials for this booming city of San Francisco. We could go on, but I just think that, you know, it's fun to remember that in 1848, this week, the president delivers what really is like it's like the starting pistol for the growth of California in one remarkable year, 1848. Meanwhile, Europe is convulsed in revolution, and we get the Communist Manifesto, which I would love to talk about at great length some other time. That's the end of the history for the moment. Hey, I wanted to, David, if you don't
Did
mind.
Did you know that I love your history stuff, and when I tease you, I'm just kidding?
Oh, yeah, I know. Okay. Yeah, thank you. There's a really interesting story, and I don't know that I actually sent it to you, so I'm going to hope that... Did I send you the story on Representative Ro Khanna? He's a guy from Fremont.
Well, I do know Ro.
Okay, so he
turns...
Do you
like Ro?
I do.
I like Ro.
He's a Democrat from Fremont, which ought to make him completely outlandish and crazy, and he's not.
Yeah, he spoke at a hedge fund conference I spoke at a couple years ago, and I was impressed with him a little bit. He did a panel with him and Jeb Bush.
Wow.
And then I was in the green room with them afterwards, and I found Ro to be quite thoughtful and reasonable and be willing to say the things that most people are not willing to say.
Well, here's one of the things that he was apparently willing to say.
Which story is this?
This is...
just tell me the first two words. No.
I don't think I have it for you, buddy. It's...
You didn't put it on the list?
I got it last night and then I forgot to send it to you, I think. It's Ro Khanna pushed back on the Twitter suppression of the Biden laptop story. I don't think I sent that to you.
I know about it.
Okay, so good. Of course you did.
So what the hell are you guys doing?
Yes.
Yeah.
So he writes, this is a Bay Area Democrat. Let's go back and... First of all, All these Twitter files have been released by Elon Musk through Matt Taibbi, the investigative journalist, and Taibbi comes up with, you know, this one really remarkable email in which all of these emails are supposed to be surrounding the events of 2020, rather, when Hunter Biden's laptop turns up. I'm not going to go over the whole Hunter Biden laptop story. You know far too much about that, and you probably can't get some of the pictures out of your mind if you saw them even inadvertently, as I did, and then, oh my God, my eyes. Here's what happened next. Twitter, of course, shuts down any reference to the one story that really uncovers what's going on with this laptop, and that appeared in the New York Post. No references to the New York Post are allowed. The New York Post is at least temporarily deplatformed. Jack Dorsey, CEO of Twitter at the time, apparently did not know about this, and 2 days later, he lifts the ban, and the story goes viral, but, you know, too late for some. Polls since then have showed that this story might have made a difference in how people voted in that election. You were going to say maybe yes, maybe no.
Well, I do actually think I've been a little surprised at the reaction to the story, because I didn't learn anything in the last 5 days I didn't already know.
But the Ro Khanna thing, I think, is interesting. That's all I really wanted to talk about.
Well, the Ro Khanna thing is interesting, and I think the Jack Dorsey thing is interesting,
that he didn't know.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
I mean, he clearly didn't know. And then why didn't he know? Because they didn't want him to know. And part of me wonders if Jack's not one of us, but I got to think that the left-wing agenda trolls of Twitter knew that Jack wasn't going to be on board with what they were doing.
I think that's likely true.
Yeah.
And that's certainly what...
Because he presented himself to Congress as sort of a little bit more libertarian-minded.
More free speech. Kind of free speech.
And Zuck has had that thing. And, you know, the left hates it. And what you've always had is the right saying, screw you, Zuck, you're biased against us. Mm-hmm. And the left has said, screw you, Zuck, you let the Russians hurt Hillary with that cartoon thing. Mm-hmm. And then Satan was punching, you know, then Jesus came and they go, that cost us the election. It was a little... So that was good. The left has never said, you're not standing up for free speech. Now, Matt Taibbi has.
Yeah.
Andrew Sullivan has.
Right.
The ACLU before 2010 would have.
Right.
I wonder if Dorsey is a kind of old school left-wing ACLU guy, who I think we desperately miss in this country.
Yes.
You go, come on, I want right-wing guys.
Right.
Well, so do I. But if I have to have a left-wing guy, I want them to be a classical liberal left-wing guy, right?
Committed at least to the First Amendment would be nice in the case of the ACLU.
We can start there and kind of build up from
there.
Yeah.
So here's what comes out of these documents released by Musk from Twitter files to Matt Taibbi. In the heat of the election, here's what it reads. That there's this email from Ro Khanna, and it turns out that Khanna knows some folks over at Twitter. And he writes to Twitter's former head of legal policy and trust. What a weird title. And pardon me for not knowing how to pronounce this man's name. It looks like Vijaya Gadde. Sounds like an Indian name, so you'll pardon me. He writes in an email, a journalist should not be held accountable. Because part of the reaction was that Twitter was violating the First Amendment. Of course, there are First Amendment principles, and there's the First Amendment. You know, the principle is we all like free speech, or we should. The amendment only applies to government censorship, not a private company's censorship. Nevertheless, Khanna writes to his friend over at Twitter, who's a very, very top guy, head of legal, head of policy, head of something called trust. And he writes...
That sounds important.
Yes. He says, I say this as a total Biden partisan and convinced he didn't do anything wrong. But the Post story now has become more about censorship than relatively innocuous emails between the Trump, the Biden campaign and Twitter asking them to block the Post story. And it's become a bigger deal than it would have been. He was making, I think, a really utilitarian argument. The free speech is good, and that cover-ups like this one that Twitter's engaged in are bad. He says now, as the congressman who represents Silicon Valley, I felt Twitter's actions were a violation of First Amendment principles, so I raised those concerns. Our democracy can only thrive if we're open to a marketplace of ideas and engaging with people with whom we disagree. Three cheers for Ro Khanna, who you already knew and liked.
There you go.
Thank you, man. I'm going to skip a story, but just read you the headline here, because, you know, having handed out accolades to Representative Ro Khanna, Democrat of Fremont, the Dems are in a savage internal fight over who's going to be head of the Democratic Central Committee. One of those guys is Tony Cardenas, who is from San Fernando Valley.
By the way, isn't it Cardenas?
Maybe it is. Cardenas. Yeah. See, accent over the A? Cardenas. So you and I would pronounce it Cardenas, but the accent is over the A.
I like to pronounce words correctly if I can.
Cardenas.
And I think you might be right and I might be wrong.
Long story short, another Californian is angling for the same top job. That's Amy Berra from Sacramento, AMI. It might be AMI. He is, I think, a doctor.
Which job is it? You're not talking about DNC. You're talking about the...
DCCC.
Yeah.
The Democratic...
Who wants that freaking job?
Something. What is it? DCCC.
Democratic Central. Congressional Caucus Committee.
There you go. Sorry, I had it all wrong. Thank you. Anyway, these two guys are fighting over whether Cardenas was involved with a porn... The boogeyman of porn. Cardenas is saying, look, man, all this stuff has been litigated in the past. I didn't do anything wrong. Nobody has anything wrong. I think this is all coming from this guy, Berra. We could talk, that would allow us to talk about porn, which is a thing that you and I always love to talk about. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge, we don't. It makes me supremely uncomfortable. So let's talk about what is, I think, one of the biggest stories in the country right now, and that's that Gavin Newsom is delivering on his pledge to punish oil companies for record high gasoline prices over the last many months. I don't have to remind Californians what that looked like. You know, in some places we were paying close to or about $8 a gallon at a time when most other states were screaming about prices in the $3 to $4 range. Pardon me. So Newsom at the time, back in the summer, you might remember, said, I'm going to hold a legislative special session and we're going to consider legislation against, we're going to tax windfall profits.
Yeah. And wasn't it like not just tax, but there was going to be some kind of a criminal thing and a lot of punishment? Yeah, definitely.
Well,
some harsh words.
You've hit on precisely the term of art which he's now trying to avoid, because when he talked about penalties and when he talked about a windfall tax, he was immediately apparently upbraided by people who know better. That's a term of art. And in the California legislature, if you start talking about a tax, you suddenly need 2/3 of the legislature to vote for it.
Yeah.
But if you call it a penalty,
right,
and you talk about price gouging and punishment, that's okay.
Well, this one should have an easy limiting principle.
Yeah.
A penalty for profits.
There you go.
It's not a tax.
This is the remarkable thing. The governor has maintained, you and I have been over this so many times that it almost doesn't require us to go over the details, but I'm just going to say it. California has a boutique oil market in which we have even seasonal blends. We have the rarest forms of gasoline available. We want a boutique oil market in California. That's what Californians demand. We just want to pay wholesale for it. And we are outraged if we have to pay more. We are people who order gas the way some people order coffee in Starbucks and, you know, penalize everybody behind them with having to hear their exacting obsessive compulsive order about milk temperature. So fees, regulations account for somewhere in the neighborhood of about $1.20 per gallon. Mm. You know what the AAA difference between California and everybody else is right now? About $1.20 a gallon. Mm. And yet Newsom persists in saying that oil companies are punishing Californians. There's no other explanation for it but greed. And I want to pause here for a moment to underscore a great tweet you sent out about Charlie Munger. Do you remember this one this week?
I remember well. I memorized his speech.
Can you tell us the gist of this? Because I think it is a really illuminating way to think about California and Gavin Newsom and our state legislature. And that's, does greed motivate the majority of people in the world?
Well, no, it doesn't. And of course, those of us who have studied biblical ethics and history know this all too well. But there's a nuance here I talk about all the time. I've written two different books that really directly get into this subject. But what Charlie Munger said was greed doesn't make the world run. Envy does. And essentially, it's funny, I had breakfast this morning with a mutual friend of yours and mine, Myron Steeves.
Oh, I love Myron.
And he was talking about this notion that, you know, for a lot of people in terms of where they're at and their economic aspiration, there seems to be a kind of consistent formula that most people need to be 20% ahead of where they are. That if they had 20% more, they'd be in a more comfortable position. And I said, the only caveat I'd provide provide to that is it's they need 20% more than what their neighbor has, not what they themselves might have. And it speaks to Charlie Munger's point that there is a sense right now people on absolute standard of living are doing better than they've ever done. Relative to some neighbors, they are not. People are utterly miserable. So what's the explanation? Because it isn't that their absolute standard of living is inadequate. So the only explanation Charlie Munger can come up with is that they're that dissatisfied with the relative delta having widened on them between them and their richer friend or whatnot. Now, connect that to Gavin and oil for me.
Sure. What Newsom is talking about, again, is ages-old envy.
Yeah.
It's that oil companies are ripping you. I mean, he uses these phrases. They are gouging you. They are ripping you off. They are stealing from you. They are thieves. He ignores constantly the lack of evidence he has for this. And let me just point out,
when oil companies are losing money, are we stealing from them?
This is a great question.
No, I mean, it's a serious question.
I understand that. I think it's a really important question.
Did
but
you
no.
know that gas prices nationally are about back to where they started at the beginning of the year now?
And I'll
from
bet.
From 350 to 550 to 350. So I have a question. Were they greedy criminals 6 months ago and patron saints 6 months later? Or do we think it might be market forces? What do you think?
I think it might be market forces. Yeah. But again, I'm just going to come back to this fact. Here it is, you know, that California has created this mess. Otherwise, you have to explain how it is that virtually every other state, including Hawaii, which imports every eyedropper full of gasoline, why is it that all these other states have lower gas prices than California? Why? Why is it just California? These guys are able to excel in gouging and thieving and stealing and piratical behavior. And it's because we have so limited the marketplace of potential competitors in oil and made it so difficult for oil companies to produce the unique blends we require, not just the seasonal ones again, but just year in, year out. We even have new legislation that is moving through, I'm sorry, new ordinances that are moving through, pardon me, cities and counties. It started off in Petaluma. You might remember we talked about this earlier this year. Petaluma banned the construction of new gas stations. And not just new gas stations, but the addition of new pumps. So if you want to replace your old pumps with new pumps, can't do it. You can't add additional pumps. Sorry, not just replacing. But if you want to add new pumps, you can't do that. So that spread to, I think it's now 8 cities in the Bay Area. And I want to say L.A., the city of L.A. and the county of L.A. are considering it. City of L.A. just banned oil and gas. Discovery, exploration. So we've got a system that squeezes producers all the time and then blames the resulting price hikes on those same producers. You know, there's a book out there that people could read if they want to know more about this. It's called There's No Free Lunch. You know, and if you needed more evidence, I'll just post this in the show notes. I won't go over all the details, but there was a lawsuit that was, you know, presented as one that was, it was in a federal court in San Diego. It was going to show us that the oil companies were in cahoots. And I will read the, you know, just a quote from the judge's decision. This is a Biden judge, by the way. Let's see. U.S. District Court Judge Jinsook Ota, I believe is her, how you pronounce her last name, O-H-T-A. She's in San Diego. She listened to 7 months of testimony from lawyers representing owners of a North San Diego County gas station against some of the largest oil conglomerates in the world. She says the plaintiffs could never establish that any communications between traders from rival companies helped those executives raise the cost of gasoline. She says, quote, while defendants would certainly have an economic motive, that is, while the oil companies would certainly have an economic motive to act in the manner alleged by the plaintiffs, that does not establish an antitrust violation. In other words, sure, they've got a motive to rig the market, but there's no evidence they did. Now, Newsom just joyously, joyfully, boldly leaps over this kind of honest intervention by a federal court, a judge appointed by Biden. And he just ignores this. He's not stupid, maniacal, perhaps diabolical occasionally, or just subject to normal human greed, let's say. But she says here, antitrust wrongdoing consists of concerted action pursuant to an illegal agreement, not independent profit-maximizing actions based on market conditions. Thus saith a Biden judge.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, I want to invoke for our friends on the left the example of Trump claims that, you know, all this stuff needs to be litigated in courts about the stolen election. We're going to litigate it in courts. And they get in court and they lose and they say, see, the courts are rigged. This is Gavin Newsom every day of every week. This is the Democrats in the supermajority in California. They don't like the outcomes of facts and then play this Trumpian game and then are outraged when Trump pulls the same BS. All right. Shall we move through quickly?
Let's do it.
All right. So we have talked about AB 257. That's the assembly bill that would set up the government to represent all fast food workers in California. Because unions have failed to organize those workers over the course of decades, the government stepped in and said, you know what? We're just going to wave a wand and we're going to do it. We are going to represent. There's some nuance in there. But the bottom line is the state of California will now represent in labor negotiations all the workers in the fast food industry. All they need is 10,000 of those workers to sign a petition saying they want it. That's it. So the people who are involved in the franchise business, the International Franchise Association, have stepped forward, gathered a bunch of signatures, and they say they've got enough now to qualify a measure that will block this, it will block AB 257. I think this is awesome. More remains to be seen. I want to read the initiative to see whether it would actually be just another kind of Lyft carve out or whether it
you
actually.
You haven't read it yet?
I haven't read it yet. Okay. It's at the, apparently right now it should be at the, I guess that's the Secretary of State who gets to look
at
this.
I bet it is going to end up being a carve out.
If in fact they succeed in killing the entire bill.
But no, I thought that this law was only for restaurants.
It is only for restaurants.
So
but
if they're making a law carving out, then you can go get an exemption carving out.
Yes, but what if this is only about, this isn't just about restaurants, it's about fast food businesses in general. So the question, that the nuance here, the detail may be that some franchises are treated more equally than others, if you get my drift.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's coming to us on the 2024 ballot, an initiative that will repeal AB 257, at least as it applies to the fast food industry, from their lips to God's ears. I hope this thing succeeds. More on that as it rolls out here.
You know, I wonder, here's what will happen. You have the International Franchise Association. You have this Save Local Restaurants Coalition. That's going to be a pretty sympathy engendering group. Chamber of Commerce, National Restaurant Association. So you're going to have a special interest, albeit on the definitely right side of this issue. So if it gets on the ballot, who's going to be on the other side? It's going to be unions wanting a higher minimum wage.
Right. Well, it's not.
And then the ads are basically going to be, stop food prices from going up 20% versus don't let the employees get screwed over.
That's right.
I think that the good guys win on that one at the ballot.
I think so too.
Think so.
You know, especially as it's revealed that the evidence, like one of the groups that you and I have called out on the show twice now is UCLA. UCLA provided the propaganda study, and it really was propaganda for listeners. I'm sorry, I can't remember which show this was in. I'll try to go back and look it up. But UCLA provided this amazing quote-unquote research that showed that workers are being ripped off. Well, who provided the legwork to get that research done? SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, which backed AB 257 when it was created. Why does SEIU, a union, want the government to step in and do what it couldn't do? Not just to raise wages in the food industry, but for two other reasons. If you raise wages in the food industry, that competition for labor increases in the marketplace, and other people might have to raise their wages in order to compete with the fast food industry. That's one. Number two is the sector, the bargaining commission that's being created under 257 allows, among other things, for the imposed unionization of all employees. And that would benefit SEIU. So one of the first recommendations this new commission could authorize is everybody has to belong to a union. We're creating a closed shop by government fiat, just as they did with public employees under Jerry Brown.
But I do want to say, because we joke a lot and everything, and everyone is, I think, in the same boat, that they're really anti-sexual harassment, and that we think a lot of the Me Too stuff in the culture got very overdone and sort of denying due process, Title IX stuff, canceling comedians for 30 years earlier, you know, getting handsy in a party or something. But I don't like sexual harassment. I think it's
a
bad thing.
It's a bad thing.
The SEIU bringing sexual harassment into the FAST Act, a minimum wage increase, and they say, this is fascinating to me, the FAST Act's necessary to prevent wage theft
right.
and sexual harassment.
That's right.
the F does it have to do with sexual harassment? Do people make $22 an hour and get harassed less?
No, they do not.
How much did those actresses that Harvey Weinstein was getting grabby with make? I bet they made over minimum wage.
They did.
But then also, I just want to point out wage theft. Is that when you pay someone and then you hit them and take the money out of the wallet? What is wage theft?
That is the term the union devised for making legal claims under the
weaponizing language.
They weaponize language.
What they mean is that they think someone's unfairly paid. That's fine. Let's have the conversation.
Yes.
And let's talk about who should adjudicate prices. There is controversy in this issue.
Yes.
Don't call it wage theft. That's a lie.
But calling it theft is like calling oil companies greedy or price gouging.
I stopped calling people oxygen thieves years ago because I thought it was rude.
But it was true. Okay. Hey, let's go to one of the things I promised last week, David, after you walked out of the room, and I never told you about this, was that I wanted to do some local stuff. So that was, you know, that was not local, AB 257, nor was the gas price deal.
Some of the Orange County local?
No.
Because you got really criticized by people for cutting off the Newport
People did
Beach
not
discussion.
Like me cutting off this discussion about Newport and Orange County. But let's talk about San Diego's Measure B. Now, here's what Measure B did, and it was just narrowly approved in San Diego. Measure B repealed a 1919 ordinance that carried out trash removal, trash hauling for free, quote unquote, right? In exchange for higher property taxes in San Diego, everybody got their trash picked up. And I'm going to talk about the origins of that thing in just a second because the history is absolutely amazing. But now what's going to happen is the city will continue to collect really onerous property taxes, which used to include then delivering, you know, making sure your trash was picked up for quote unquote free. That was part of the deal. You're going to pay higher property taxes. We're going to pick up your trash. But now you're going to pay for your own trash pickup. You're going to pay your own bill. Are your taxes going to go down commensurately? No, not at all. Your taxes will not be reduced. This means a windfall to the city of about $80 million. Well, who benefits from that besides politicians who love to spend other people's money? Government unions. Who supported Measure B? Government unions. So take one breath and then imagine how long it will take the unions. It's over. They've already done this to claim the city has $80 million sitting around. How come they're not giving us higher wages? They're being stingy. And you're going to have a bunch of folks in the city council, maybe even up at the county when this spreads out, say, oh, you know what? We've got $80 million here that we just discovered under our pillow, in the mattress, in the backyard. We're going to spend that on paying government employees more and enriching their benefits. That's how this works. While you're thinking about that, let me just go back in time to the period from the late 19th century to about 1919 when the People's Ordinance, which included free trash pickup, quote-unquote free, was first installed. This is where I think it's hypothetical on my part, but I couldn't help thinking of pork barrel politics. This is how trash pickup used to work back in the early progressive era, the late 19th century. So trash pickup was an entirely voluntary thing. People pitched their garbage into over their neighbor's fence on vacant lots, dumped it in the ocean, dumped it into rivers and canyons. They just left it festering in their own yards. And the progressive movement is really about like, hey, let's get engineers in to solve problems like sanitation and homelessness and vagrancy and that sort of thing. Let's figure this all out with engineers. So engineers come out and they start trying to They start trying to twist the knobs and figure out like, how do we get people to, they start with public persuasion programs. Hey, don't dump your trash in your neighbor's yard. Put it in a nice can. Nobody does it. Why? Because it's expensive. They finally come to the conclusion that the only way to make sure that trash pickup is universal is to make it quote unquote free. Make some people pay more in taxes so that everybody gets free trash pickup, right? So far, so good. Here's who opposed that. People in the trash hauling business. Here's why.
Yeah.
This is the most amazing discovery that I have made in months. This used to be a pork business. You picked up garbage from people, like restaurants and hotels, for instance. Those were great providers of food garbage. And you took the waste out to your own pig farm. Now, you charge the restaurant a price for taking away their trash. And then you took it to your pig farm on the outskirts of town, we hope, and you fed it to piggies. And then you sold those piggies back to the hotels, back to the restaurants in the city.
Yeah.
So they started, pardon pardon the pun, larding up politicians to make sure that their interests were protected. So I'm not saying, because I haven't done any research on this, that the etymology of pork barrel would certainly seem to come to this, where you have literal pigs being fed on garbage, and that whole system, that whole free market system, providing a kind of self-regulating marketplace, right? But it wasn't good enough because poor people didn't produce the right kind of garbage for piggies, and they couldn't pay these people to pick up their garbage. So you had this showdown between the progressives, that the engineers, the regulators want to make sure that everybody's trash was picked up, and the pig farmers who would pick up your garbage, feed it their pigs, and sell you back the pork. It's a really amazing kind of process when you think about it, and I'm sure there are ways they could have leveraged that better. But in the end, the piggy farmers all lost out. Pig farms were pushed off to the margins of the community and then basically shut down because they were very, very expensive to feed hogs. So the garbage collection became universal under the People's Proposition of 1919 in San Diego. And the details of just the rise of the progressives, the rise of the engineering and managerial class in the late 19th century, early 20th century, is just one of the most remarkable periods in America. It was called the city manager movement, this whole goal of the progressive goal of divorcing politics from actual government services, and it's paid us huge dividends in some regards. But do you have a top of the mind sort of response to that? Because I'm of two minds on the city manager movement and the attempt to divorce politics from city services. Like, on the one hand, why should politics play any role in asphalting streets? Other than the fact that we just want our streets asphalted.
But what do you mean by politics? Are you talking about public streets?
Public streets.
Well, then how could it not? To some degree.
Yeah, to some degree it must. But the goal was to make sure, in the city manager movement, the goal was to make sure that you weren't getting this kind of Jacksonian to the victors go the spoils kind of situation. And that, in fact, real city services like clean water or sewage or trash pickup, which is ultimately expanded to things like AB 257 and eliminating gasoline, that's where the regulatory state starts, I think, with modest and reasonable aims and ends in catastrophe. So I just wonder if you have any quick thoughts about that. I know I'm surprising you with an academic question.
No, it's not a surprise. It's the kind of issue that I think matters a lot, that thoughtful, it's a very, very niche person who would be interested in the nuances between a city manager is unelected and a city council who is elected, and various how sausage is made within a city. Mm-hmm. I am not
literally.
I think that it's a borderline anarcho approach that talks about there being no magistrate oversight to city services, to water, streets, and sanitation. But I'm obviously, as we've talked about a thousand times, for decronyizing it within the realm of possibility. And then I do think that there are some cities that have a heavy imperial role of managers and staff that are unelected, and other cities that have a much more involved and engaged council. And the only reason I can't provide a more exhaustive and systematic set of principles and applications around these issues is I haven't studied enough too, but I do know what the questions are to ask. Mm-hmm. But I haven't answered them myself, so I want to stay humble on it. But I think it's important, and I probably should study this more.
Well, I think what's interesting to me is, especially in the context of our conversation about oil, all of this stuff with gasoline and our fuel recipes and our boutique market starts off when you're a baby and I'm a little kid, and we have in California smog alerts, smog days, we called them, when we were all locked up in our classrooms and our homes, the windows shut and the doors closed because the smog outside was so positively toxic and acrid and bad for your health. Like, I can remember days where I couldn't breathe well. Football practice at Mater Dei in Santa Ana in 74 or 75, hot summer days, two-a-day workouts, and the smog so severe that your eyes stung and it hurt to breathe deeply. And we were advised against going out to practice, but we did it anyway because that was the 70s. So the regulation begins in earnest with honest things that need to be corrected, but it ends in this insanity. And I think all I can come up with, David, is that socialism's failures can only be solved by more socialism if you're a socialist. And the same would apply to progressivism. It would apply to almost anybody who's so ideologically hermetically sealed in their ideas that they can't think outside
that. Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay. Two last things I want to talk about real quickly. The teachers union.
And we should do a USC thing because I think it's worthy of our post-mortem on the game.
I think we should.
Do you want to get that out of the way first or do it last?
I promise I will spend 30 seconds on each of these last two stories. I'll give you the headlines.
Take whatever time you need, Will.
The teachers union in Clovis Unified remains out of reach. There is no teachers union in Clovis, California. That is the largest largest school district in California without a teachers union. And huge surprise here to you, my friends.
Can you imagine the horror those kids must be going through? What do they do?
They outperform most other kids in California. Clovis.
I don't even think that's possible. That's assuming. Are you saying the ones that after you net out the psychological torture of not having a union rep, that then those kids are doing okay?
The teachers union does not exist in Clovis, and their students outperform students in all other districts almost.
There's got to be a bunch of teachers that are living in like
squalor.
Yeah, just utterly chaotic conditions.
That would be the claim of the union. It's simply not true. Their wages are commensurate with teachers all over the place because they do have to compete in a market, blah, blah, et cetera.
Oh,
they do very well.
What about the parents, though? I mean, do you have parents trying to like get involved? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. It's a free-for-all.
Last story. All these stories, by the way, these local stories, San Diego, Clovis, and this one from Palo Alto, these are sent to us by listeners, and I want to thank them for responding to my appeal for local stories that we really ought to be talking about here because they have first principles at stake. And here's one. Here's the headline. This California city asked where its recycling went. The answer wasn't pretty. Here's the short, the brief. The city of Palo Alto wanted to find out where all of its recycling was going because there were stories in the news that the trash was simply being dumped in third world countries, places like Laos. That will take recycling because it's just about the only thing they can do to participate in the global economy. Turns out, don't know. Why? Because the city's investigations have not offered much clarity. Palo Alto's best reckoning today is about 40% of its recyclable material stays in North America, where it's supposed to be processed according to strict environmental and labor standards. The other roughly 60% goes abroad, mainly to Asia, with next to no transparency about its face. The main obstacle that Palo Alto encountered in this investigation was that half a dozen companies that trade the city's recyclables on world markets declined to name their trading partners, citing business reasons. Okay, so we don't know where our recycling is going. You're doing all that good work to separate your plastics, your glasses, your food waste, and God knows where it's ending up.
Do you separate?
I do, yeah. I'm a rigorous separator. I also save water. I'm really good at this. It just appeals to my kind of puritanical Catholic sense. I was brought up wearing school uniforms and saving water. My parents
school
are very
uniforms
thrifty.
Have an obviously measurable, quantifiable social impact.
So does saving water and not buying, wasting stuff.
The recycling thing you just got done saying, it doesn't do anything. It's all going in the same place.
That's true. But it's a vestigial reflex from being raised by two parents who were born in the Depression.
See, I think that you're right in what you explained, both cause and effect, but then the problem is that there's one thing you're doing that is worthwhile, uniforms, and one another thing that's not.
You're just mocking me for a habit born of puritanical parents who happen to be Catholic.
I don't think that puritanical should be the adjective. Mm-hmm. First of all, you could just go Catholic.
Could I say thrifty?
I mean, I don't know why you got to read the Puritans into this.
Oh, those poor people. Okay, David, talk to me about USC. We had a tough game.
You know what?
Tough
game against Utah. It's so funny. It's really sad for the people out there that live their lives the way they do. I don't want to call them losers, but I will say this. I'm very glad I'm not them. That they reach out and be like, oh, man, you must be. Are you just dead? Is it over? Like, what's going on? Are you just screwed? Can you believe it? And I go, no, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It's done forever, right? No, actually, now we got to go win a bowl game.
Yeah.
Now we got to get ready for next year. See, this notion that you get up and you fight on is what it means to be a Trojan.
That's right.
These poor, timid souls that are living their lives generally envious of those who figured out what fight on means.
Yeah.
You almost feel kind of bad for them. First of all, they've wrapped their identity in trying to hope somebody else experiences a misfortune instead of themselves achieving anything or being somebody productive in society. But second of all, you would think that the whole notion of fight on would be almost a tautology. Like, how are you handling it? Oh, I'm fighting on.
Right.
It was a heartbreaking loss. I think everyone objectively knows two things happened at once and they fed off each other. Mm-hmm. That game was about to get opened up.
Yeah.
40-0.
By USC. Yeah. Yes.
Caleb tears his hamstring on a 59-yard run that was a run for the ages.
Yes.
And for whatever reason, Utah didn't catch on right away that the most mobile quarterback in college football had lost his mobility. So the offense is still in a unique position. And then USC gets a fumble, takes the ball away from Utah. It's about 38-yard line. I suspect if they score on that drive, they end the game.
Right. I agree.
Because there is a sense in which nobody can be expected to come back from a great football team like SC down 3 touchdowns early. It snowballs. But Utah's a really tough team. They're tough kids. They fought. They then get the ball back, go and score. And then all of a sudden they realize, see, USC just ran downhill on both UCLA and Notre Dame because you can't pack the middle with your front seven when a quarterback can get around to the edges like that. And all of a sudden they realize Caleb's stuck in the pocket. So what they did is Caleb's hamstring took away Caleb's mobility. And then the defensive alignment now took away our running game. Even then, somehow we still ended up really getting some significant activity out of our wide receivers downfield. But that simultaneous, now the offense needs to score every single time, and they're not going to do it with a quarterback with a torn hamstring. And then you have the defense that just clearly just wasn't, they got out-muscled and out-hustled all night, didn't tackle, and it was just very bad fundamental football. They had two interceptions that they dropped. You know, our defense relied on that all year. They weren't great fundamentally, but they relied on big play takeaways, and they just didn't get them. The ball, in this case, literally was slipped through their hands, and then Utah just out-muscled them and won the game. Very, very proud of the coach.
Yes.
Very, very proud of the team.
Yes, they
very
fought.
Proud to be a Trojan. Embarrassed for the non-Trojans that thought they were going to try to talk trash to me. They do not know what they're up against.
Now I got
you
to say,
you will take away my spirit over my dead body.
Right.
You worthless losers.
Hey, can I say...
And by the way, I'm going to the Cotton Bowl.
Are you really?
I am. I'm going to go.
Oh, my gosh. It's going to be... And we're going to play Tulane. And can I just admit, no offense...
Hasn't been to a New Year's Day major bowl game since 1939.
Amazing.
I want to apologize to Tulane fans because I'm at a conference in San Francisco Saturday. Conference is done. I'm up with a group of the speakers watching the game, and we're talking, hanging out, having some food. And Tulane beats, I think, Central Florida and storms the field. And I go, well, who would storm the field beating Central Field? And Central Florida. The next day, I'm reading ESPN, and I find out, oh, they have not been in a situation like this.
In like 90 years.
So, you know what? Storm the field.
Yes.
I like it. And let's get it on.
I am so excited.
They're undefeated. I don't know if Caleb's going to be able to play or not. And I stand by this, too. USC is one of the best teams in football. They're not one of the best four teams in football with Caleb. They are in the number 4 through 8 best teams in football with Caleb.
I think we're ranked 10 right now.
Yeah, which is nonsense.
Right.
We would beat 5 of those teams.
Right.
But listen. Without Caleb, I think we're 7-5 this year.
Yeah, I agree.
That's how special it is. He's come back next year. And so as far as all the Bruin, this is the difference between USC and UCLA. USC is upset with an 11-2 season.
Yes.
And Bruins are thrilled with an 8-4 season.
There you go.
That's the difference.
I want to just highlight one thing. Raylan Goforth, linebacker, who's now in the transfer portal for reasons you and I should talk about. But he delivered one of the most ferocious hits I've seen in college football in
that.
Years
it,
and
it was
years.
Violent. It was beautiful.
And it was a clean hit.
Very clean.
And I want to say this. Cameron Rising did not only not drop the ball, he lost his helmet and he pops up smiling.
Yeah, that's a tough kid. It's a tough kid. Now, he's not going to be playing on Sundays, I don't think, for other reasons, but he's a real tough kid. Yeah, I don't think his game is suited for the NFL, but he's a tough kid.
Is it too much run first, do you think, on his part?
Well, first of all, that hit might have knocked about 10 years out of his life.
That was harsh.
I'll put that
in the show notes. It's both amazing for the ferocity of the hit by Raylan Goforth and for Cam Rising's endurance. I mean, I thought getting up, and then he played the rest of the game. Like,
and
that
played
is
very
amazing.
Well.
Played so
played very well.
Well.
Yeah, so congrats to Utah. I do think look, it's just, it's tough when you play for programs that are totally content with mediocrity. And then they get an opportunity to go have those upsets. You know, they come to play.
Yeah.
And they and so I think they're like 9-3 or something. Right, right. They lost to some bad teams. You know, Florida.
But God love them. I hope they beat the trash out of Michigan.
They're tough. They're playing Penn State in the Rose
Bowl. Oh, I thought it was Michigan.
No, Michigan's in the playoff. They're number two in the country.
Oh my gosh, I'm such an idiot.
So yeah, Georgia is playing Ohio State, and Michigan is playing TCU.
I'm glad you know this. Thank you. Okay, well, I will root for Utah as I do.
And to all of our Trojan listeners, say fight on.
Fight on.
It was a heartbreaking Friday night, but it was a wonderful Saturday morning because we got up, and you know what? We fought on.
That's right.
All right.
Thank you, brother. That's all the time we have today. You can always find this podcast on the National Review website, but it'd be easier for you and better for us if you subscribe and, of course, rate and review the show. Listen, don't stop listening or fast forward because there's a secret message in here for you. You probably know this already, so it's not a secret. This is how the algorithm works. If you rate and review the show, if you subscribe, that actually raises our profile on all of the podcast platforms. So please email us with your comments and story suggestions, as so many people did this week. Thank you all. You'll find our personal email addresses and other fun details in the show notes. You can follow us on @TheRadioFreeCA on Twitter. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, thank you, David. We give thanks as ever to session producers Lucas Klaus. Thanks, Lucas. Brian Tong, Glenn Hall, researchers Houston Reese, Sheridan Swanson, and Alex Kachatrian, and to all of our friends at National Review, especially National Review's podcast producer Sarah Schutte. Thanks, Sarah. Thanks also to Metalachi, the LA-based mariachi metal band, for our music. La Revolución continúa la semana próxima.